Up to now, we have seen the concept of the hero mostly in terms of men of action. But it's very hard for us to imagine in our culture that action can be words, because so often we make the antithesis between words and action, as if words themselves could not be action. But in a song culture, in many situations, when you're saying something, you're also doing something. And the power of the word can be overwhelming that when a certain hero says a certain thing in the right time and the right place, it's not only an act, it is the most absolute act that the song culture can imagine. Lecture 13, the title of it is Champions of Decay, which I translate in the title as justice, but we will see that justice is only the telos, the outcome, the accomplishment of a process, an ordeal. That's why in number one, I give you long-range and short-range definitions of decay. I say that it's justice long-range, but it's merely judgment short-range. And I'll get back to this antithesis in a minute. But for now, let me try to flesh out the meaning of decay another way by considering what the opposite of decay is in ancient Greek song culture, and that is hubris, which I'm translating for want of a better word as outrage. And almost immediately, I like to divide it into three categories of living things. Number one, human. A wonderful example of hubris in human behavior would be the chief of the suitors, Antinous, whose very name means antithetical to the mind and to all the symbolism of the mind, all the metaphors and metonyms of the mind that we have seen. Number two, there's hubris in the animal world, and there, I guess I can summarize it in just a few words. It's mostly male animals, and it's being oversexed and over-violent in combinations of that. And then number three, my favorite, the plant world, where hubris manifests itself as undergrowth or overgrowth. And when I say overgrowth, I specifically mean, ta-da, excessive wood or leaf production. Now, if a plant that is supposed to bear fruit is excessively producing leaf and wood, what atrophies, what gets shortchanged is the fruit, is the product of the harvest. And therefore, in ancient Greek terms, what you have to do to a plant that is sort of runaway producer of wood and leaf and that doesn't produce enough fruit is to do what? Is to prune it. And in ancient Greek, the technical botanical way to express the idea of pruning is to say straightening. Which brings me to the deeper meaning of decay, number three. I'm saying to you that if you really try to trace back the meaning of this word that we translate as justice, as far back as I can go in time, it would be something like a straight line. And in fact, that's the number one metaphor for decay, straight line, as opposed to hubris, which would be a crooked line. And the other big metaphor for decay, besides a straight line, would be a blooming garden, orchard, or grove. And in a sense, if I'm telling you that the pruning of a plant is to straighten the plant, you can see how these two metaphors merge, that the metaphor of decay as a straight line or as a well-tended garden, it only makes sense then that way if you're tending the garden, you're straightening the garden. And let me do a little bit more about the opposite, hubris. a crooked line or a desert or an overgrown jungle. In other words, where vegetation just doesn't work in a seasonal way. The concept of a crooked line, if you think about it, is multiple, whereas the concept of a straight line is unique, in the sense that if you're going along a straight line, think of yourself as traveling along a straight line, you're going in one direction. It's a unidirectional process. Whereas if you're going along a crooked line, technically, at any given point, as you're traveling along the crooked line, you could be facing in any one of 360 degrees. So it's multiple. And you see where I'm getting to is that decay can be absolutist, can be unique, whereas hubris can be relative and multiple. So let me push the metaphor world and the metonym world a little further. We have a blooming garden or a field as the opposite of a desert or an excessive wood leaf production. Number five, I'm comparing some of the ways we use this kind of metaphor world similarly in English. Think of when you say that you're speaking directly. If you're speaking directly, presumably it's not ambiguous. There are not several meanings. There's one meaning, and it is in the mode of a straight line. Number six, we come back to decay as direction, directness, directedness. And I think only now that I'm starting to worry about social justice, do we think back of the Iliad as missing something. How many times did you really see in the Iliad or even in the Odyssey an explicit mention of social justice? I submit to you that the idea of social justice is an idea that emerges out of the Iliad and the Odyssey, but it's almost never spelled out directly to you. It's almost as if for us, when we're exposed to the Iliad and the Odyssey, we have to figure out that straight line for ourselves. And remember the time that you met in section and that you did postings before for the section, and you were considering the litigation scene, which was a centerpiece of the pictures represented on the Shield of Achilles. You remember that litigation scene where there was a plaintiff and there was a defendant, and the plaintiff and defendant were locked in an eternal struggle over what's the right formula for making things okay again. And in a sense, only in situations like that did the issue of decay come up in a direct way, and there it was a legal case even, where people are supposed to decide what's right and wrong. And what fascinated me about that particular part of the Iliad is that you have concentric circles expanding ever outward of people who are supposed to judge what the most equitable, what the most just formula for settling the dispute might be. But even there, as you keep going further and further out with these ever-expanding concentric circles, you never really get to see what the outermost circle is. Who are the most outer circle of people who are going to judge who's right and who's wrong, or to what degree is one party right and another party wrong in that dispute that takes such a central place in the Shield of Achilles? And it's almost as if the outsiders, the outermost circle, are the ones who will be the ultimate deciders of who is right and wrong. And you could even say that those outsiders are the most recent generation of people who are exposed to the issues of this dispute. And the most recent people at this second in the march of time would be us. This could be very different from wisdom poetry, which is what my focus is for this week. And I've had to compress it into essentially one lecture, which is today. It makes me very nervous, considering how much time I've spent of my own research work on wisdom poetry. But wisdom poetry is all about settling, deciding, discriminating, judging what's right and what's wrong. What's morally right, what's morally wrong, what's legally right, what's legally wrong. And in a sense, we saw the relevance of the concept of the hero most clearly the last time we met, when we started considering the agenda of the Odyssey in terms of the king finally achieving equilibrium in his own kingdom, in terms of the king as the body politic, in a sense rebuilding the body politic just by reasserting his identity as a king. Before I go back specifically to the Inos of Tiresias, which was my focal point last time we met, look at the passage that I give you in number 9, where you have the image of a king in a blooming garden or field. And I love this word field because you can't tell just by hearing the English word field whether it's nature or culture, whether it's natural or artificial. And Odysseus in disguise is telling Penelope, his wife, that her kleos will reach the heavens like that of a king who upholds good decay. And then look what happens if justice prevails in the local land. Then the earth flourishes and the people prosper. So again, you have the idea of social justice and vegetal harmony, vegetal equilibrium tied together. And you notice in the Odyssey that you really can't have Odysseus ever talking about his own kleos, even by himself, because his kleos depends on the kleos of his wife. Similarly, Penelope's kleos cannot be mentioned without thinking of Odysseus's kleos. So this is a couple who have a stake in kleos that both of them have to contribute to. And the same goes for practically all the images that have to do with Odysseus and Penelope. So it's not just a reunion of lovers, which is one aspect of the story that I have emphasized. It's also, so to speak, a reunion of the body politic in terms of husband and wife, king and queen, and their epic fate, their destiny as heroes is intermingled, interwoven, interrelated. And with those thoughts in mind, let me go back to number 10, which is like a review of what we talked about last time, and which speaks directly to the discussions you're having in section this week concerning, how can I put this, the true meaning of Orbios. What is it to be really blessed? And I think here again, the concept of metonymy will come in very handy. So I do again a one-sentence review of what metonymy is. It's where you're establishing meaning by way of connection, by way of linking, so that if one subject touches another subject, the two subjects get connected in meaning. And you see how we're already seeing it in terms of whatever works for Odysseus will work for his wife Penelope and vice versa, that their meanings touch each other and interweave with each other. Well, let's think about this word Orbios precisely in terms of metonym by looking at it again in number 10. You remember Tiresias is saying this riddling prophecy about what will happen to Odysseus beyond our Odyssey, so to speak. And we compared the symbol or the sema of the dead sailor to the symbol of the dead hero in a blooming garden or field. And again, I'm thinking of culture, agriculture, and how, in terms of the prophecy, once Odysseus is buried in his land, then the people who are inhabitants of that land will be Olbioi. It's almost like they'll be Olbioi just by being in contact with the corpse of the hero. This goes back to this fundamental principle of hero cult, which we can reconstruct historically, which is that the hero's body, once the hero is dead, is a talisman of fertility and prosperity to the community that worships the hero in the native land. This is a fundamental historical fact of hero cults, which keeps resonating in all the song culture that we are studying. And for Odysseus, and this is what I was trying to drive home the last time, the symbol that means sailor is dead. You remember I drew a picture of it on the board. That symbol is also the symbol that means the harvest is complete. And for different constituencies, that picture of a mound with something sticking up from the mound that looks like either an oar or a winnowing shuttle, for some people it'll mean only one thing or another thing, but for somebody who travels, somebody who goes from one set of values to another, you can see the double meaning of a symbol like that. But you can only see it if you've traveled, which brings us to yet another metaphor, that is to say, the reading experience as a world of traveling from one culture to another, seeing how different cultures view the world in different ways. And to wind up on number 10, if the cult hero is Orbios, if this hero that you're worshiping in your local earth is Orbios, that means that since you're connected to it, since you're living on the land, you too become blessed because the hero is blessed. And this is the lesson, this is the fundamental lesson that the most powerful and rich and prestigious person in the whole world, Croesus, does not understand when Solon, the wise man of Athens, answers him in this riddling way about who is the most obvious of all humanity. Remember how Croesus thinks that he is the best candidate, and then it turns out it's these alternative candidates. And those alternative candidates, as you're exploring in section, are textbook cases of heroes as cult heroes, as people who are worshipped as heroes after they die, and who, by virtue of their death, their full story, guarantee the prosperity and fertility of the community. So I hope it's all coming together. Another way it will come together is when you meet in section next week, because next week you will actually see a historical person talking about what it feels like, what goes through your mind when you're worshiping a hero. And all of these agenda that we're exploring so far on a literary level, you'll see on a gut level of a personal experience as retold by somebody in the ancient world. Now, speaking of gut level of experience, I'm very interested in your being exposed to many different media in seeing the concept of the hero. And that's why it's very important for me that you go to the museum this coming week, and we will have a sign-up sheet already on the stage if you want to sign up right now for a given time. If you can't sign up today, right after class, you'll be able to sign up on our website later. But remember that each of the groups that will visit the museum, which will be in many ways preoccupied with exactly what I'm saying, these real-life experiences of hero cults, each of the sections will be sort of filled up, will reach their telos at number 19. So the earlier you sign up for the most convenient time for you to go to the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, the better. And while I'm on the subject of timing, I'm going to try something. Yancy, it may or may not work. But this has to do with a cinematic vision of what I'm talking about, this beautiful coming together of an orchard, the image of a hero who is planted, so to speak, in the orchard. And we might imagine this hero as being in a paradise-like situation in another world and in another time. But as far as we, the worshippers of the hero, are concerned, let's say in the 5th century BCE, as far as we, the worshippers, are concerned, the presence of the hero is the corpse of the hero, which guarantees the seasonality that the hero's very life represents once the life has been lived, once death has happened. The combination of veneration of social justice and contemplating the beauty of a garden or the beauty of a natural setting that is somehow perfectly synchronized with human life is something that is elaborated in many different cultures. And in Japanese culture, of the second half of the 20th century, there is almost a cult of imagining a kind of golden age when humanity and nature are perfectly synchronized. And once people do that, they can't stop thinking about a perfect death, being buried at exactly the right time and the right place, all time coming together beautifully. And that, this is why on December the 1st, I'm going to be showing Kurosawa's masterpiece, Dreams. And what I want to do today is show you just a few minutes on the very ending. And you're going to say, oh my God, our professor is unethical, he's showing the ending of a movie. But this is ending in the sense of telos, it's ending of coming full circle. And I'll just take the rapid if you resent me for showing how it ends. And I'm even going to tell you how it reaches the end, because it's so complex. Every time I see a different angle. You can shut your ears if you don't like to hear this ending, but basically, you've had a wanderer, a traveler, who is called the dreamer by the director, Kurosawa. And he's gone through the most hellish experiences, including radioactive poisoning, because Mount Fuji has exploded, and in a sense, all the pollution of the world has infected this one traveler or dreamer. He's really gone through hell, as you'll see when you see the full film on December the 1st. But then he kind of wakes up and sort of goes through a new stage of experience. And after the most hellish of all experiences, where we figure he has died, suddenly we see him in the most beautiful place in the world, as far as Kurosawa's imagination goes. And I just wanted to capture the mood of what happens. You thought he was dead, but he's still there. And he's witnessing a funeral. And he's witnessing the funeral of an old man who is welcoming death, and it's not really death because it's so peaceful, so serene, so everything coming together. And where we're going to join the action is our traveler, our voyager, our dreamer, is just seeing the coffin of this dead person carried past him. Then he's going to go to a spot where he had been told earlier in the story that somebody died because they were very sick and they were very polluted. So you could say, well, maybe this is his own grave. And sure enough, there is a marker. I'm not going to use Greek words here, but you can use them in your own mind. There's a marker there. And then in a very minimalist, ritualist way, he leaves a bouquet of flowers, wild flowers, at the marker, and then crosses a bridge. So there's not that much action, but I think it captures the perfect coming together of everything in the context of somebody's death, in the context of a beautiful grove or garden-like setting where all vegetation and all the universe, all the natural universe becomes synchronized with humanity, but humanity as having lived a productive and creative life. So let's just capture the mood for just a second. Yancy? Thank you. Not much action, right? But even the way the whole bridge spans the bottom of the screen to the top of the screen, it all means something. Everything means something in the way it's set up here. And even the direction he's coming from and the direction he's going, once you see the film, has all sorts of meaning about how this set of pictures is connected to the previous sets of pictures that Kurosawa has been showing. It's an amazing exercise in montage, which is this principle in filmmaking of expressing meaning by way of how you connect one thing to another thing to another thing. For us initiates into Greek film culture, we wouldn't call it montage, we would call it metonymy. Whatever we call it, it's a remarkable expression of meaning through very, very subtle connections. And you have to read everything in this picture. You'll see there's so many things in Kurosawa's film, Dreams, that what I'm going to have to do is keep showing bits and pieces of it until we finally see it on December the 1st, and I hope all sorts of things come together. But right now, what I want to emphasize is, if an ancient Greek saw this particular shot, they would say, this is Hesiod. This is what Hesiodic speech, the word of Hesiod, is all about. Because everything that you read, when you read the Theogony and the Works and Days, and you intelligent people could read all of Hesiod in an hour. But everything you read is this highly compressed statement of what it is to be just, what is social justice, how to express it by way of natural and artificial things coming together. In other words, let's put it another way, natural and man-made things coming together. In this case, the water wheels are the way Kurosawa tries to do it. And if there were one word, I think, that Kurosawa would use if he could speak ancient Greek to express what this is when everything comes together, it's what it is to be odios. That's what the whole film is about. But the things you have to go through to reach that stage, oh my. Anyway, number 11, heroes in cult, that is to say, the way we worship them. And just wait till you see this beautiful description of a worshiping ritual that I give you for next week's section discussion. The way you worship heroes in cult is a key to seasonality in agriculture. And I'm not playing with words when I'm connecting the cult of heroes, the worship of heroes, and agriculture. These things are directly connected. Number 12, cult heroes are described as the guardians of justice. And I mean justice in the long-range, absolute sense. And there's a beautiful description of cult heroes in Hesiod Works and Days, which I give you in 12a, where you notice that essentially it's almost like all the forces of social justice at all occasions of the world are guaranteed by cult heroes, if you think of them as a group. And I think if you start working backwards from wisdom poetry, which I have to give you in this highly compressed form today, you will see that there are indeed hints about social justice and ways to try to start thinking about how these heroes that we've seen in the Iliad and the Odyssey may or may not be just and may or may not be doing things that are right. And number 13 is a very, very good example. I'm pushing you to think in this way because when we make our big switch next week from wisdom poetry to tragedy, we're going to see some of the same characters that we saw in epic, especially Agamemnon, the big opponent of Achilles in Iliad 1. And we're going to see them in a very different medium where now what we're going to have to do is figure out, are they just or are they unjust, and when and how. And these were the questions that we couldn't ask directly when we were reading epic. But wisdom poetry provides us with the bridge to start talking about what's right and wrong about heroes in tragedy. So this is a very important bridging moment, so to speak, this very compressed presentation I'm giving you today about social justice through the words of Hesiod. But to repeat, you can start retracing some of these agenda even in the Odyssey. Number 14, I try to give you a summary of the Odyssey in terms of social justice. So this is my ultra-compressed summary of the Odyssey in terms of Dike. Here it is, number 14, that Odysseus is intrinsically noble and extrinsically base. Remember, when he puts on the disguise, he neutralizes his social status, so people can think that he's at the very bottom of society, he's at the very bottom of the socioeconomic scale, and yet the suitors are just the opposite, especially Antinous. Whereas Odysseus is intrinsically noble and extrinsically base, Antinous is extrinsically noble and intrinsically base. Once you look inside his heart, so to speak, you see that there is no morality, there is no justice. And the wisdom poet Theognis in 14a says it beautifully, that sometimes in order to achieve social justice, you have to disguise yourself because you have to have the right timing before people can discover you for who you really are. And I think this will help you understand, at least in terms of ancient Greek song culture, how you can morally justify Odysseus's not telling people who he is in the second half of the Odyssey until everything comes together and he can exact justice. Number 15, we must remember that it is nous, which is this ability to, how shall I say it, to read, that brings together the intellectual, moral, and emotional requirements that it takes to read. And that somebody like Hesiod, when he speaks, is speaking in such a way that all of these things are coming together at exactly the right time. So what he says in exactly the right order, supposedly, and in the way that these values of justice can come out perfectly. In the Odyssey, you might say, here's my one-sentence summary of the sailor part of the Odyssey story. It's almost like, here's a sailor who's trying to go from point A to B, from Troy to home, in a straight line. And he can't go in a straight line. What does he have to do? He has to zigzag because he keeps getting deflected. He keeps having to suffer through detours. So couldn't you say that the entire Odyssey is a crooked line trying to become straight? And a crooked line that becomes straight only at the very telos, only at the very fulfillment, if you like, the end of the Odyssey. And in a sense, that's what you see whenever you hear Hesiod speaking. He's speaking and speaking, and there's social injustice. And then the more he speaks, the more social justice starts asserting itself, so that by the time he's finished, social justice can actually happen. And because the way he speaks creates justice, that's why I'm saying in number 18 that he is a hero by way of being a singer. So in this case, just the way he talks is enough to do something, to make something. And remember what we talked about, crisis as separating the wheat from the chaff? Look what happens in the Works and Days as Hesiod himself announces it in number 19. That Zeus sorts out what is right and what is wrong with his judgment. And Zeus's judgment is absolute, so it is an absolute sorting out. While Zeus is making absolute judgment, Hesiod is talking to his unjust brother. And by virtue of how he talks to his unjust brother, he can actually bring about justice. But it can't happen overnight. It can't happen instantaneously the way Zeus does it. When we humans try to look for justice, we have to struggle towards it. And it's, again, a matter of a crooked line becoming eventually a straight line. But it doesn't happen instantaneously as it does for Zeus. And in Numbers 21 and 22, I show you that when you read the works and days, you will actually see the symbolism. You'll actually see the symbolism of how the way Hesiod speaks is the way a just king, an absolutely just king, would speak. And that number 22, to say a theogony is to authorize what justice is. That's how important all of the wording of Hesiod is. And by the time that the, shall we say, the story of Hesiod is finished, we finally get to a place where Dike is no longer the unjust judgment of earthly kings, but the absolute justice of Zeus himself, who rules, so to speak, in heaven. So it's a way of trying to make the real-life world correspond to the absolute world of Zeus by struggling towards something, and in the end, achieving that something through your words. In number 30, I give you what I consider the ultimate exercise in nausea self-control, where something that I could spend a whole semester on, I compress into those 4 points. And I hope you have a chance to read through the works and days with those 4 points in mind. I'm saying that these very complex riddles that, or einoi, that Hesiod uses in the works and days, all add up cumulatively to this symbolic statement of what is justice, how to get the absolute out of the relative, simply by staying true to the right word or saying the right thing. And in the end, number 31, a man of Dike gets rich. But this is, you might say, symbolic, while the man of Hubris eventually loses it all. So what's remarkable, as I say in number 32, is that Hesiod is talking to Perses. Now remember, Hesiod is the just man, Perses is the unjust man. And while he's talking, the social injustices that you start with start sorting themselves out. And the curious thing is, by the time you reach the end of what Hesiod has to say to Perses, all the social injustices have been straightened out. And he hasn't done anything, he's just been talking. But as I say, that is doing something. By talking, you are doing something, and that's what the works and days does. Now, I know this is so challenging and so difficult, and I'm so depressed that I have to say all of this within the compressed space of 1 hour, that I want to cheer you up and cheer me up by going to something that is really vulgar and awful as a way to end my lecture on wisdom. I'm thinking, isn't the best way for me to illustrate how things can go right by showing you how things can go wrong? So am I going to show you something that goes wrong? And I hope, even if you can't stay to the very end, you stay as close to it as possible. We still have 5-6 minutes for me to illustrate this wrongness. It's very raunchy, and I'm very embarrassed for myself. Okay, so, but can I do it anyway? And you can... Oh, indulge me, for God's sake. Okay, it has to do with a popular song in English. This is just a popular song. And this popular song is a first person talking to a second person. And the thing is, while he's talking to the second person, things are happening. So I think this is the perfect illustration of how, when you're talking, things can be happening. But then I'll show you a very quick movie version of this, where the movie misses it completely, misunderstands what the singer is trying to do, and where the action is not only misunderstood, but in a sense subverted. Okay? So, I'm talking about a song by Roy Orbison entitled Pretty Woman. And I can't sing well, so can I just do the key words? Pretty woman walking down the street, pretty woman, the kind I like to meet, pretty woman. I don't believe you, you're not the truth. No one can look as good as you. Mercy. Oh, it gets better. It gets better. Pretty woman, won't you pardon me? Pretty woman, I can't help but see. Pretty woman, well, you look lovely as can be. Are you lonely just like me? Pretty woman, stop a while. Pretty woman, talk a while. Pretty woman, give your smile to me. Pretty woman, yay, yay, yay. This is where he forgot his lines. Pretty woman, look my way. He made it rhyme, though, because he's so clever. Pretty woman, say you'll stay with me, because I need you. I'll treat you right. Come with me, baby. Be mine tonight. Pretty woman, don't walk on by. Pretty woman, don't make me cry. Pretty woman, don't walk away. Hey. It's even better. Okay. Okay. If that's the way it must be, okay. I guess I'll go on home. It's late. They'll be tomorrow night. But wait. Da-da-da-da-da. What do I see? Da-da-da-da-da. Is she walking back to me? Yeah, she's walking back to me. Yeah, pretty woman. Now, what has happened? First person to second person, we thought that she went on by, but she came right back. And it happened while he was talking. Now, do you want to hear the mistake? Julia Roberts thinks that she's being so clever and that she needs to make a film that is an antidote to her goody-two-shoes image. So she makes a movie called Pretty Woman. And I'm going to show you just this one little clip where she thinks she's going to pay back for all the social injustices that have been committed against her. But the curious thing is, this beautiful Roy Orbison song is even truncated because the people who made this movie didn't realize that there was action going on in the song. And what Julia Roberts does in the actual action is a contradiction of what the song says. And so the song even has to skip some parts of it. So if you can stay for a few minutes, I'm going to play you this piece, which is prophetically called Mistake. Big Mistake. And this is going to justify everything that I hate. This is going to be ugly. This is going to be exactly the opposite of the Kurosawa image of beauty. But maybe this will help us appreciate decay even more. So here we go.
Okay. Stop fidgeting.
Get rid of your gum.
I don't believe you did that.
Yes. I am Mr. Hollister, the manager. May I help you?
Edward Lewis.
Ah. Yes.
Do you see this young lady over there?
Yes.
Do you have anything in this shop as beautiful as she is?
Oh, yes. Oh, no. No. I'm saying we have many things as beautiful as she would want them to be. That's the point I was getting at. And I think we can all agree with that. That's why when you came in here...
You know what we're going to need here first? We're going to need a few more people helping us out. I'll tell you why. We're going to be spending an obscene amount of money in here. So we're going to need a lot more help sucking up to us, because that's what we really like.
Oh, sir, if I may say so, you're in the right store and the right city, for that matter. Anything you see here, we can do, by the way. Get ready to have some fun, okay? Mary Pat, Mary Kate, Mary Frances, Tova, let's see it. Come on.
Oh, that's absolutely divine.
Excuse me, sir.
Exactly how obscene an amount of money were you talking about? Profane or really offensive?
Really offensive.
I like him so much.
Louis, how's it going so far?
Pretty well, I think. I think we need some major sucking up.
Very well, sir. You're not only handsome, but a powerful man. I could see the second you walked in here, you were someone to reckon with.
Hollister.
Yes, sir.
Not me. Her.
I'm sorry, sir. I'm sorry. How are we doing, ladies?
Oh, Edward, where the hell are you? The word's all over the street.
Morse is going to raise your offer, pal.
He's countering. He is a tough old bird.
He knows the Navy contracts are stalled. Where's he going to get the money?
I don't know. I think he's throwing in with the employees.
He still needs someone to underwrite the paper.
Find out who it is. I'll be in the office in an hour.
Yeah, okay, you got it.
You're on your own. You have to go back to work. You look great.
She has my card.
And we'll help her use it, sir.
Pretty woman, walking down the street. Pretty woman, the kind I like to meet. Pretty woman, I don't believe you, you're not the truth. No one could love as good as you.
I was in here yesterday. You wouldn't wait on me?
Oh.
You work on commission, right?
Yes.
Big mistake.
Big.
Huge. I have to go shopping now.
There you are. Did you notice? Don't walk away, and then that's it. There's no action. There's only superficial action. Bad reading. Big mistake.